Hey, welcome to the Plant Yourself Podcast. I'm your host, Howie Jacobson. Quick reminder that the new book is out. You Can Change Other People, The 4 Steps to Help Your Colleagues, Employees, Even Family Up Their Game. This is a business book, but it's also a personal book. I wrote it from my experience as a coach, helping people change entrenched self-sabotaging behaviors. And I put all my knowledge and all of Peter Bregman, my co-author's knowledge, into a book to help you do the same thing with the people that you care about in your life. So it's available right now. It is for sale wherever books are sold. You know, Amazon, Barnes & Noble, bookstore.org, your local independent bookshop, my personal preference, if you can do that. And I would love for you to get a copy. That is one amazing way to support me, is to help the sales of the book, and to read it and implement it. And if you like, go on Amazon or somewhere and leave a review. All right, so let's get to today's episode. All right, I really hope after listening to this conversation, you go out and get the book that my guest wrote. The book is called Burn. New research blows the lid off how we really burn calories, lose weight, and stay healthy, by Herman Ponser, PhD. But it is about so much more. It is about the scientific method. It is about understanding evolution and life as he says, an attempt to turn energy into babies. And once we understand the mechanisms that have driven our species where it is from an evolutionary perspective, you will stop beating yourself up for being overweight. You will stop beating yourself up for your cravings. You will understand the relationship between our agricultural system and our obesity epidemic and global warming and climate destabilization. The way Herman, Dr. Ponser, thinks about these things is as a true scientist, as someone who is interested in making hypotheses and collecting evidence. And one of the things you'll notice in his book and in our conversation is how clear he is about the limits of our knowledge and what constitutes an acceptable test of a hypothesis. And if you have been immersed in the diet and nutrition world for a while, you will have encountered many, many people who are flying way over their skis in terms of theories far outstripping data, far outstripping the evidence. And that's one thing that I really got from this conversation that Dr. Ponser will not do. So there are a bunch of questions I asked him, kind of softball questions, and his answer was, I don't know, or we don't know. We don't have that data yet. What you know, maybe you should design the study to test that out. All I can say is the book will help you become a better human to yourself and to our entire planetary family. Interestingly, it has 4 stars on Amazon, and I looked at why, and almost all of the negative reviews say something like, well, it wasn't a really good diet book. And by that, I assume they mean it didn't give us a 7-point plan or a bunch of recipes. Instead, this is like, going and finding the world's greatest computer chip and then people rating it poorly because it doesn't have, you know, a keyboard and monitor and mouse. Well, that's not the purpose of the chip. The chip goes into something. So whatever you want to do about your own diet for health, for longevity, for weight control, this book will give you insights that will help you. So let's get right to it without further ado. Herman Ponser, welcome to the Plant Yourself Podcast.
Thanks for having me on. Looking forward to it.
Yeah, so let's jump right in. I have this bad habit of assuming that everyone who's listening has already read the book, and I just want to discuss like the finer details, but we should probably start with a little bit of an overview. I kept making notes like, this is the sentence that defines the book, and I had like 30 of them. So I'm curious, like, what do you think? Like, if you had to say what the book says, what your work has said, you know, in 30 seconds, what would be the high point for you?
Sure. I think the overarching idea is, this is how metabolism actually works. This is how your body actually burns calories and all the ways that happens. And then the next layer is, this is how the energy that we bring in our diet affects your bodies. And this is how the energy that we burn off with exercise affects our bodies. And understanding how those two pieces, those two big pieces in our daily lives, interact I think is what we spend a lot of the time in the book on. And the whole, you know, the idea here is that we're taking an evolutionary approach to this. We're not starting off with some diet that we want to sell and then figuring out how to make everything tell that story. We're starting off with the evolutionary biology of how the human species got to be the way it is, and using that as our lens to understand these sort of big concepts in biology and in life and in our, you know, in diet and exercise.
Yeah. So after reading the book, I have to say, like, I started looking at everything in my world in terms of energy balance.
And, yeah. Yeah. You know, well, I mean, you know, like, I love to say life is a game of turning energy into babies. You know, that's from an evolutionary point of view. That's what it's all about. And if you're in a positive energy balance, you're bringing more calories in, you can do that. So your body likes to be in that state. You know, if you're in energy, negative energy balance, you're losing energy, you're losing weight. Your body hates that because, you know, it's 500 million years of animal evolution that doesn't want to be in that energy loss state. And so, yeah, it really does come down to that. I mean, that's why I got into this was, I'm not a dietitian or a clinician. I got into this questions about energy expenditure in humans and other species because I want to understand how, you know, how life today got to be the way it is, especially for our species. And energy is just such a key component of that. It's this sort of through line that unites everything. That's my research agenda. That's my research program, is understanding how the body works from that kind of perspective, because I just think it's fascinating.
How did you get into that when you were like studying in high school or as an undergrad? Like, what led you to be so interested in this?
I had no idea on earth what I wanted to do in high school with my life. And then I got to college and I took a course, a seminar in human evolution. It was a small class, and it was these two professors. One was a biological anthropologist, which means that he was interested in how evolution shaped our bodies. The other guy was a cultural anthropologist, interested in how, you know, the culture that we live in shapes the way that we behave in ways that you don't even know. It was great because it was a conversation between them throughout the semester about sort of culture and biology and how they interact and interplay. And it was for the students, it was eye-opening on every level, on the biology level, on the cultural level. And I was really fascinated by the biological part, the way that sort of our evolutionary past shapes our lives today. And I just thought, man, I grew up in a part of Pennsylvania that's an old coal mining town that is now a factory town. So they make pressed metal parts where I grew up in St. Mary's, Pennsylvania. I grew up in Kersey, but anyway, and they make little widgets that fit like in the anti-lock brake systems in your car and that kind of thing. Right. So everybody I grew up with, their dads worked in the factories. My parents were high school teachers, but everybody else, you know, seemed they were, dads were working in the factories. Mom's working, who knows what odd jobs or in stores or whatever, sometimes in the factories too. Nobody had academic jobs. You know, nobody was a professor that I knew. Yeah, when I got to college and had that course, and then I thought, are you telling me I can do this for a living? This, you can make a career out of this? I was just, my mind was blown. So then ever since then, I just knew that if I could make it work, I was going to do this. Ask these questions, do this kind of work, and I couldn't feel luckier about being able to really do it.
That's awesome. It's so interesting that you know, your background is in a coal mining. What better, like... You know, like the last chapter of the book kind of makes the point that energy is energy, whether we call it calories or miles per gallon or kilowatt hours. That, you know, that all that coal was essentially going to helping people spend fewer calories with their physical bodies somewhere in the world. Right.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's crazy, right? We think about this energy economy totally separately from our internal energy, but that separation is fiction, you know, it's total fiction because we're using, what's fun about that. And that was a really fun chapter to end on for me with that book and explore that. Cause I spent the first 8 chapters of the book talking about all the internal energy we use and diet and exercise and all the physiology. And then to say, guys, but you know, we have to also be aware that there's a parallel track of energy expenditure that actually isn't separate from us. You know, ever since humans have been using fire, we've been using this external energy source to kind of to do the work that our bodies otherwise would do. So to digest our food. That's why, you know, nobody can live on a raw food. You can live on a raw food diet, but people generally don't do well on raw food diets. And a raw food, wild food diet, I don't think is even tenable. There's no credible evidence of hunter-gatherer groups that don't cook their food, for example. So our bodies actually need a fire to do this external work of digestion so that our bodies can get enough energy out of the food that we eat. So when you realize that, and fire is a million and some years old, you're like, oh my God, we're actually tied to this external energy economy, to the coal mines. You know, it isn't something that we can just decide to do or not do. We actually have to do that, have that external energy expenditure. But how do we do that in a way that doesn't kill us? That's the question.
Right. And what got to me when I was putting this together from the book is like the energy expenditures we don't have to see them. So like, I do know people who are surviving and doing quite well on raw foods diets and even kind of chubby, but they're eating lots of nuts. And so I have a pecan tree in my backyard. And for me to eat, to get processed the pecans, to get like 100 calories of pecans, takes at least 50 calories and a couple of hours. Like if you're buying bags from Costco, you're not cooking it yourself, but you're still getting the benefits of somebody's fire.
Yeah, that's a really good point. Plus, you know, your friends, I imagine, the people who do well on raw food diets, they go to supermarkets full of foods that never existed in nature, right? Because we've changed them through farming. I'm not even talking about like GMOs or anything like that. Just the act of farming for 10,000 years, 12,000 years, and selecting the varieties every generation. The farmer's doing this, of course. This is what you do when you farm. Pick the fruits that are the have the most meat, have the most flesh, have the most energy. And now, you know, corn today doesn't look anything like corn looked 10,000 years ago, for example. So strawberries are completely different. It's fun. Or for that matter, the oils, right? You have to press all the oils to get all those olives or whatever to get the oils out of that. All that's energy, right?
Right. And you point out in the last chapter, which is kind of scary, that, you know, one of the pieces of evidence for a completely unsustainable agricultural system is that we spend 8 calories to get one.
Yeah. Isn't that terrifying? You know, no species could live like that forever, right? If you went into the woods and found that, you know, the squirrels or the deer or whatever had to burn 8 calories of energy just to get 1 calorie of grass or you could know right away that's not going to work. But our entire world economy is based on that, which is kind of scary.
Yeah. Like we're all Bernie Madoff, right?
That's right. And when the check comes due is when we're going to run out of fossil fuels, which is like in 100 or maybe 150 years. Like even if you didn't care about climate change, right? This was scary for me writing the book. Even if you couldn't convince yourself to care about climate change or didn't even want to believe it was real, the reason that you need to get rid of fossil fuels in our energy portfolio is that we're going to run out of them, even by the most optimistic estimates, in 100, 150 years. That's nothing. That's nothing. That sounds like a long time to us because we're going to be dead by then. But in the history of a species, that's a blink of an eye, you know? And there's no guarantee that we're going to figure out what to do instead of it. So if we don't start now and work on it.
Right. But let's talk at the micro level.
Oh, sure.
Which is where your work is getting a lot of attention. And after I read the book, I tried to explain the concepts. And I'm a pretty good explainer. And I tried to explain it to my fitness buddies, and there was tremendous resistance. Like, but no. So the punchline for them is when we exercise, we don't burn more calories than when we don't exercise. Essentially.
Yeah, So that's kind of the interesting, weird, crazy result. And so let's talk about how we get there. So we get to that really counterintuitive result by work with people who are really physically active. For me, this was work with the Hadza hunter-gatherer community in northern Tanzania. So these are traditional hunter-gatherers. They hunt wild game and gather wild plant foods. And they're getting as much physical activity in a day as a typical American gets in a week. And they have the same energy expenditures. We've measured this, and we didn't expect this at all. We've measured this using doubly labeled water, which is this really accurate technique. They have the same daily energy expenditures, same calories per day, as Americans and Europeans and people in other industrialized, you know, populations. And so you can be 5 to 10 times more physically active, and your average energy expenditure per day is no different than if you're the sedentary person. Now, that doesn't mean that day to day your energy expenditure doesn't fluctuate up and down. Of course it does. If you run a marathon tomorrow, you're going to burn more energy than if you didn't, you know, than today when you didn't run the marathon. So it's going to fluctuate, but your body is basically adjusting the background level of expenditure to keep those fluctuations hovering around the same level, whether you're really active and so, you know, you're getting lots of exercise every day, or if you're less active and you're not, the average expenditure over the sort of week-long time frames is going to be the same, or very close. You know, you're not going to see that that activity effect clearly at all.
Mm-hmm. And this has been replicated, right?
So we saw this with the Hadza community. We've seen this with other traditional communities that have really active lifestyles and have the same expenditures as everybody else. We can see this in the lab. So if we take mice or, you know, other lab animals, and we make them work harder for their food, so we have a week when they don't have a wheel to run on, and then we give the mice a wheel to run on, and we watch them get more and more active over the course of a month. By the end of the study, they're running, you know, 20,000 rotations a day on their wheel, and their daily energy expenditure is the same as it was in baseline when they didn't have access to a wheel at all. In humans, we see this when we get people in exercise programs. And so, you know, we say, look, you're going to be in this study and you're going to exercise, you know, the equivalent of about 20 miles a week or even 30 miles a week of running. And we're going to enforce that. We're going to make sure you're in the gym doing that work. We're going to measure it and have you there and keep track. And those people, they start off burning more energy at first, but by month 6, month 10, you know, a year out, their energy expenditures are about the same as they were when they started. And so it's this adjustment that your body's doing that you're not even aware of that is the kind of an interesting observation and a kind of I guess it's a discovery about how the body works that we weren't really appreciating before. And I think people still push back against.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It sort of reminds me I've read Daniel Kahneman's work on, you know, system one thinking and system two thinking. This is like system zero thinking, the thinking that happens that has to override your brain because your brain would just mess it up. Conscious mind.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, so here's what people, I think here's where people stumble on this as you know, the phenomenon of it, which, you know, the data are very clear. This is something that happens sort of whether you believe it or not. These are what the data look like. So why do people have such a resistance to this idea? Well, a couple of things. First of all, I think they misunderstand it in some ways. People understand this to mean, and this is either because I didn't explain it well or because the media doesn't explain it well, but people take this to mean that, you know, on a day that I work out and a day that I don't, that I burn the same number of calories those 2 days. And that's not the point here. Your body isn't making day-to-day adjustments or on the fly minute-to-minute adjustments, right? When you exercise, you do burn more calories. And if you have a big day, you're going to burn more calories than you do on a really quiet resting day. So there will be these day-to-day fluctuations. That's not the argument. The argument is what those fluctuations sit on top of, the sort of resting baseline energy expenditure. And that's what seems to be kind of rising or lowering like the tides, right? And so when you get really, really active, your body goes, oh, we're really active. And so we're going to lower all that other stuff so that we still don't, you know, sort of, we keep the average, weekly average kind of the same as it was before we were really active. So, okay, so that's the other thing that people, I think, trip on is that there is so much of that background energy expenditure that you can easily make adjustments to that to sort of soak up and absorb this new active lifestyle that you have. And people aren't aware of that, I think, because, and this is one of the reasons I wrote the book, actually, is that we're told that metabolism is all about exercise. And your body has 37 trillion cells that are all active all day. And most of your energy is burnt on stuff things that you aren't even aware of, right? So that other piece that your activity is floating on top of, is actually much bigger than the activity piece. And so adjustments there can easily absorb, you know, sort of long-term changes in the activity part.
Right. So help me understand my own experience. So in 2016, I started working on a book with a guy who had lost 230 pounds, who had, you know, adopted a whole food plant-based diet and become a competitive runner. Yeah. And so to work on the book, I'm like, well, I'm going to, you know, partake. So I'm going to run a 50K. And so I went for training for 50K, which is basically 50 to 60 miles a week.
Yeah.
And quickly lost 20 pounds and kept it off until I injured my leg like a year and a half ago. And then the weight started creeping back up. Even like, so how does that experience fit, you know, as an N of one into the
thing? Yeah. I think there's a couple of things going on there. One is that it takes a while for your body to adjust. It doesn't adjust overnight, like I said. And so I would bet you that the weight that you lost from that really huge increase in running, what were you running before you started doing the 50 to 60 miles a week?
Like very little.
Yeah. Okay.
So you went from 20 minutes and walked for half of it because I was convinced I was shook, you know.
Okay. So you're going from kind of literally zero to 60 here, right? Yeah. Overnight. Well, a couple of things. First of all, it's going to take a couple months for your body to adjust. So I would predict, and you can tell me if I'm wrong, this is like the 20 questions, but I would predict that almost all the weight you lost in the first 2 or 3 months.
Yeah.
Is that true? Or was it a continuous glide path?
Yeah, no. By the time I ran that, the 50, I started in May. By the time I ran the 50K in October, I was willing to take my shirt off for photos.
And you were already at that flat line probably, right? You probably already basically plateaued.
Yeah.
And you kept that weight. So in the adjustment period, your body was burning more calories at first to the 60 miles a day. And you probably were a negative. I mean, you must have been a negative energy balance. That's the only way that weight loss happens. And so, and then your body adjusted. And by October, your body was like, okay, this is what we do. We're this active, right? Uh-huh. And then you again radically changed your lifestyle again and had to adjust to that. And in that meantime, your energy expenditure hadn't adjusted. And so now you're in positive energy balance and you gain weight back, right? So that's what I would see. I think that's probably the biggest piece of this is that it takes body's time to adjust. Mm-hmm. A couple other things going on there, which is 60 miles a week might be at the point where you start to threaten the body's ability to adjust. Actually, we did an experiment where it was an experiment. We followed these people who ran from Los Angeles to Washington, D.C. They ran a marathon a day, 6 days a week, sometimes 7 days a week for 5 months from L.A. to D.C.
That was and Bobby Ballinger, right?
What's that?
Bobby Ballinger.
That's not a name I know from this group. It was Bryce Carlson was leading the science on it. And, I'm blanking on the people who did who led the thing. It's called the Race Across the USA. And they do this on bikes on bicycles, I think yearly, but this was the first time, or maybe the second time it ever been done on foot. Anyway, those folks, you know, so a marathon is about 2,500 to 3,000 calories just for the marathon. And you add that on top of the 25 to 3,000 calories you're already burning each day, just normally, that's your body can't adjust to that. That's beyond, if you can run a marathon a day, that's beyond where your body can adjust. So now we're talking, we're pushing beyond this constrained model where your body is able to absorb that much. So that's 26 times six is, you know, 180 some miles. That's more than you were doing at 60 miles a week, but even 60 miles a week might be threatening where you are able to adjust.
Gotcha.
So I think there's a couple pieces there. I think you were right at the limits of your body's ability to adjust. I think you were, saw all the weight loss early before your body had adjusted. And then on the flip side of that, saw the weight change again after your body was injured. That's my prediction. One question there would be, why did you get injured? Was it an overuse injury?
I think so. I think it's like I've always had sort of a wonky knee. But the other thing I'll say is after every race of marathon or greater distance, I get sick a week later. And yeah. I think I'm beginning to understand that now after reading the book, when I've, you know, about energy yeah. and where the energy gets taken from.
Yeah. Well, that's what I was going to say. The other thing is that if you push yourself 60 miles a week for however many months that was, you know, one thing I talk about in the book is you can go above this ceiling. We can think about this, your body's sort of innate desire to keep energy expenditures within a pretty narrow range. I call it constrained energy expenditure, but whatever you want to call it, we can think about it as kind of a fixed budget that your body runs under for your whole life. Now you can deficit spend, right? You can go above that ceiling. You can go above that fixed budget for a while. And so people who run a 100-mile Western States ultra marathon or a Kona Ironman or the Tour de France, which is happening soon. Is it happening right now? It's happening right now. I don't know what stage we're in. You know, those athletes are definitely above whatever that fixed budget is, fixed energy budget is, but they, just like any other fixed budget situation, they can't do it forever. They can't deficit spend forever. They're going to come back down. And where you hit, where it, like when the bill becomes, when the bill comes due, how quickly that happens depends on how high above your fixed budget you are. And so it might've been that you were doing fairly well above your, like at or near your fixed budget for a while. And it felt fine. And you didn't know the bills come and due in whatever it was, 10 months, 12 months, but it did. And that's when your body was like, yeah, we can't repair anymore. We're done.
And yeah, it didn't make any sense in the sort of old machine model that I was operating under, in which, oh, well, I'm just going to burn fat. Cause I was never, you know, I got lean, but I never got cut. I never got like 8%, 6%, you know, Instagram.
Right. Right. Yeah.
And I'll just keep burning fat, but like, I love your evolutionary model of that the hypothalamus is the business manager.
That's right.
That you have to, that if you're exercising a lot, then it takes energy away from other systems.
Yeah, that's right. So we, you know, again, you got your energy on exercise, it's kind of fluctuating on top of this other stuff. Well, what's the other stuff? It's immune system. It's your production system. It's, you know, stress reactivity. It's your nervous system, which has to keep its ion balances right to keep your nerves firing. All this stuff costs a lot of energy. And some of it's, not all of it, but some of it's, you know, kind of optional. So inflammation, for example, this quick inflammation response or this really high stress reactivity response is optional. You don't have to do that. And your body can begin to cut away at those things when you exercise, which is one of the reasons exercise is so good for you, which I want to stress. We're not saying don't exercise, but exercise because of the way it kind of helps you regulate your energy budget. That's actually one of the reasons to do it. Now, if you're spending too much energy on exercise and you don't have enough energy for repair and, you know, and immune function and all that stuff, yeah, now you're in trouble. So that's the other side. That's the kind of the dark side of these trade-offs is if you push it too far, you get into overtraining syndrome, that kind of stuff.
So the big question I had after reading the book mm-hmm. Was, so basically to paraphrase my understanding of it, we have a sort of a fixed energy budget, which mm-hmm. every species sort of has one based on its evolutionary history. And we have one that serves a really good evolutionary purpose. When we exercise, when we move, when we are active, we then shift the caloric spend from these other things to exercise, which is why exercise is so good for us, because then we don't have a hyperactive immune system. We don't have a hyperactive inflammatory system. We don't have a hyperactive stress system. So my question is, why, when we don't exercise, do our bodies spend all this energy on dumb shit?
Yeah. Yeah, that's a good question. Those are really hard questions. Those kind of why questions are tough to answer. I don't know, but here's a way to think about it. Your body is not as smart as we think it is, right? Your body has, you sort of evolve these physiological rules, if this, then that kind of thing. It's like a computer program on that. It's that level of smart, right? There's no actual thinking thing, wondering about what's best for you into your future, right? There's this sort of if then kind of things going on in the background. And the if then on how you spend energy on a immune system could be, look, if you're in energy, positive energy balance, if things are really good for you, then spend the extra energy on immune system and spend it on stress response, because this isn't going to last forever, right? Evolutionarily, those would have been really rare times that you would have been flush with energy. Usually you're working your butt off and food's hard to get. So, you know, in the food good times, you spend that energy when you can, but you know that that's going to be the first expense to go when things get back to normal. But we never get back to normal in this weird world that we live in. And that's the problem.
Okay. Because I did have a theory. It veers into evolutionary psychology, which I'm hoping you don't hold much stock in.
Not usually. Depends on. No. Yeah.
So I'm way over my skis here. But it occurred to me, like, if we are, like, there's a difference between being in positive energy balance because I just got a kill, or it's avocado season and I found the orchard.
Sure.
Versus, and you point this out in the research, being sedentary, like completely sedentary, like almost all of us. And my thought was, maybe the brain goes, oh, I'm completely sedentary. That must mean I'm injured, I'm sick, and therefore those evolutionary responses would make sense. Is there anything?
Yeah, I don't know. So an interesting piece about that is that the kind of behavior that we all are familiar with from having the flu, which is you just want to curl up and sleep, you know, that behavior is kind of understudied, and it does seem to be kind of an evolved response. You get away from people, you stop eating, and you just kind of wait it out at the illness. Could that, on the flip side, be how your body's responding to the sedentary behavior? I don't know. I'm skeptical, but you know, the science is not short on interesting hypotheses. We're short on good solid tests. So I look forward to your test of it. It's an interesting idea.
No, I was just going to throw it to you.
I don't know. I don't know. Before you embrace the cool explanation, which is what we all want to do, of course, you have to test all the boring ones and show that they don't work. Right. So I don't know.
That's what I love about the book so much, that it's so, like, when people are like arguing, because everybody argues about metabolism and exercise and nutrition and diet and health, and it's so tempting to create these stories.
Yeah.
Everybody's stories are good. I remember reading Wheat Belly and thinking, wow, that makes so much sense. Right. Mm-hmm.
And then,
you know, it's like, well, how can everybody be right? Well, everyone's got a different baseline metaphor. And, you know, so when Gary Taubes, who's one of the best, you know, storytellers. When he puts it to the test, the data don't line up.
Yeah, that's right. And then, you know, and then he goes on interesting, you know, explanatory tours, apology tours for the model. Right. And, you know, well, the data don't fit because they didn't do the study quite right, or they didn't, you know, it wasn't long enough, or, you know, whatever. And at some point, this is what separates people who are doing the science from people like Gary. And, you know, I think I want to start off by saying, I think Gary has, you know, has good intentions with this, wants to get people healthy, and that's great. And people do have good outcomes on low carb diets often, not for the reasons Gary argues, I don't think, but when you start walking away from the data and saying, well, I don't care what your study says, I don't believe it. I don't believe not just one data point, but I don't believe this whole constellation of studies that don't support the model. I think all the studies are wrong and I like my idea. No, sorry, that's not science anymore. That's just belief.
Are you seeing any evidence or any labs doing work that are trying to disprove your theories? Is there still room for sort of interesting debate, or is at this point, is it just sort of cults?
No. I mean, I think, you know, I think there's a couple of things that we haven't figured out yet. I mean, this is a new idea, relatively speaking, and it's going to take a long time to kind of, you know, have it. What has to happen in science is you have a new idea. People don't believe it at first, and that's fine. And then you get enough observations of the same thing, and you say, look, this is a real thing that we have to take seriously. And I think this is where we're at right now. Now let's figure out why it's happening and figure out all the sort of the parameters on this thing. And I think we're at that stage now. And there are people who are going to say, look, you know, we had these people exercising for a few months and their energy expenditures did go up. Okay, well, that's interesting. What was it about that group that didn't fit the overall scheme of what we see? We don't know those details yet. What makes people more or less likely to sort of compensate faster or slower or more or less? Exactly what is it that's happening internally at the cellular level with this compensation? You know, we're talking kind of casually about your immune system getting turned down or stress reactivity getting turned down, but those are whole cellular pathways that have to, you know, there are predictions to be made there about what happens. And that you got to show that. You can't just, you know, the evidence is there in terms of, you know, the epidemiological evidence, but where can we actually pin down the pathways? So yeah, people are pushing back in a good way. It's been really fun to have those debates. People are skeptical, and they should be. They should be skeptical of everything, you know? But I think we're kind of pinning down exactly the sort of shape of this thing and how wide, you know, how, if the budget is fixed, how fixed is it? And exactly how is it that you meet that fixed budget? Those are the next set of questions.
Mm-hmm. Gotcha. So one of the things that I loved was sort of the evolutionary explanation of like this hominin experiment and then how we diverged from the great apes. And so you talk about like you're 300 in dog years. And the humans are like, we are the outliers. It's not the dogs, right?
That's
everybody,
right.
Everybody else ages quickly, except for like us and sea turtles.
Yeah. Us and sea turtles, other primates are pretty slow. That's right. So there's these two big things that have happened evolutionarily that have sort of parked us where we are in the world of you know, in the tree of life right now. One is that around, you know, 50 or 60 million years ago, when primates got their start, so primates are this group of mammals that we belong to, so apes and humans and monkeys and lorises and lemurs, something must have happened there that changed their metabolic physiology really kind of significantly, because when we measure all primates today, including us, all primates are burning half the energy that you'd expect for a mammal of that body size. Okay, so if we look, humans, you know, let's say you have a 150-pound person, average energy expenditure for a 150-pound person might be, you know, 2,500 calories a day, something like that. We go to 100-pound antelope or carnivore or anything like that in the wild, and they're burning 5,000 calories a day, right? Twice as much as us. So, And then not just humans, all primates are shifted low. And that's, we think, why we grow so slowly, right? I've got a 15-year-old dog. Love that dog. But, you know, I hope she lives forever. But realistically, you know, she's at the end of her life, probably 15 years old. That's all really old for a dog. And, you know, here I am in my 40s, and I hope I'm, you know, I'm only middle-aged, you know? And so we live really slowly. All the animals are fast. And we think it's that slow life is because of our slow metabolisms, we think. And then within the apes, we have a, you know, compared to chimpanzees and gorillas and orangutans, humans have faster metabolisms. We think that helps us pay for things like big brains. And so there's a sort of a secondary shift that happens in our lineage, in our little branch of the primate bow. But yeah, I love those evolutionary pieces.
Yeah, because when you think about it, when you think about my body in terms of how it betrays me in the modern world and how it makes no sense, it's very disempowering. But when you put it in your perspective of like, it's trying to keep within this energy budget, it's trying to mitigate risk. Like almost everything you talk about, every evolutionary strategy to some extent is either an overextension for opportunism or a response to mitigate the risk. Like I love how you talk about like what made humans humans is the and in hunting and gathering. It's the fact that we have to share.
Yeah. I love that too. Just the observation that's so key. So that's fun. That's the little, you know, why do humans have faster metabolisms than chimpanzees and gorillas? Well, it's because we have this really weird way of getting our food, which is that we all kind of each go off our different ways and get different kinds of food, and then we come back and share it. So, you know, that's hunting and gathering, right? Half of us are going to go hunt today and half of us are going to go gather. And if the hunters come back with a zebra, that's awesome for everybody. If they come home empty-handed, that's okay because all the gatherers will have brought home the sure thing, the plant foods. And it's only that balanced portfolio, high risk, high reward versus the sure thing. And you combine that and that's unbeatable. And that's why there's 8 billion of us and we're talking via satellite and, you know, that we run the world right now and potentially run it off a cliff, but that's a different story. But this is why we're so successful is because of that and that sharing. And yeah, I think that's a really important piece to take home is just how connected we all are. You know, the divisions we make amongst ourselves and the tribalism and the blue versus red or the whatever it was. If I was growing up, it was the Soviets versus the US, right? I mean, we always want to have this in versus that group, but actually it's the sharing and it's the community that makes us so strong. And if we can kind of understand that, that's a really powerful way to live our lives.
Right. Of course, we grew up on the opposite sides of the track because I was a Rutgers fan.
Oh. Well, you know, we can still be friends, though. That's all right. Yeah, I grew up at Penn State. It was Penn State versus the world every Saturday, you know, in college football season.
Right. Yeah. And so what you're saying is like we figured out how to eat our cake and have it, too. We have these long lifespans and pretty high metabolisms.
High metabolisms for a primate. Yeah. I mean, we're still low compared to everybody else, but we're like, you know, we're the little bump off of the norm for primates. Yeah.
Right. And you make the point that that's probably how our propensity for fat gathering, fat storage, that if we're going to be spending fast, we need a way to collect when times are good.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's right. And it's absolutely true for sure that we are the fattest ape. You know, you go to the zoo and you see these pot-bellied gorillas and pot-bellied chimps and they look maybe like they're fat, but actually that's because they have big intestines because they eat so many leaves and so many, you know, they don't have any energy density in their diet like we have in ours because we cook our food. So our diets are super energy dense. And we eat meat, which is also more energy dense, but and, you know, fats and all that kind of stuff. But the point is they aren't really fat, actually. They're actually leaner than you and me. So a chimp in a zoo has 10% body fat, which is like Olympic level, you know, athlete. And we have fast metabolisms and we're also the fattest. So right there, you're like, wait a second, then my usual model of how energy expenditure and fat go together is wrong. Cause how can you be both things? But that's absolutely right. We are.
So I had a question about that because, you know, our cats and dogs could become obese.
Mm.
And I'm wondering if we, you know, I mean, no IRB would let you do this study to feed, yeah, you know, apes in zoos the way we feed ourselves. Like,
but, no, you can actually, so you're right that no IRB would do it. But it's been done. And so if you go, there are famous cases in this, you know, in the ape sanctuary and zoo world of really obese apes. And it doesn't happen very often, but inevitably when it happens, it's because they're being fed, you know, human foods, the vast diversity of foods, you know, they get, you know, there's all these, it's interesting stories, but they're all kind of, you know, case studies, but you get these apes that kind of, you know, get really friendly with their handlers and their handlers just, they love them and they want to do nice things for them. And so they do what they would do for their, for their human friends. And they bring them, you know, cake and they bring them, you know, whatever they love, high energy human foods. And they just, bah, they can't resist. And they get fat the same way we get fat.
So one more sort of a specific question from the person who actually turned me on to your work, who told me to listen to your amazing conversation with Robin Chatterjee. So the problem with losing weight is if we exercise to lose weight, we're going to reduce other caloric expenditure and we're also going to start, you know, eating more. Because if you're more active, you eat more. And if we try to diet, you know, which, you know, you call like this you know, metabolic restriction.
Yeah.
Then our, you know, then we, the hypothalamus tones down the thyroid gland and it sends our brain into paroxysms of ecstasy every time to see a calorie. Right. So it's like, we're fucked. So has there been research on what is the caloric deficit that can lead to sustained weight loss that doesn't trick the, you know, doesn't trigger the body into going to emergency mode?
Yeah, I don't, there needs to be more. There's not a ton of work on sort of what that tipping point is. At least not that I'm aware of, but the, here are, you know, it's hard to track calories anyhow. So here's, if you're going to kind of take this home and try to use this, this is what you should be using as your guide. You should be eating a diet that fills you up so you don't feel like you're starving. If you feel like you're starving, probably those mechanisms are kicking in. So you need to try to find foods that fill you up on less. So, and we know from satiety experiments that foods that are high in protein, foods that are high in fiber, can both work. And so, and actually, by the way, the protein piece is probably why low carb diets work so well for people, because protein is very satisfying and fills you up. The fiber piece is probably why whole food plant-based diets often work really well for people, because the fiber fills you up. So there isn't like, you know, anyway, these diet wars about who's right, I think is actually, they're all playing around on the same system. But if you feel like you're starving and you feel miserable, that's probably a good indication that your body has engaged those energy sparing mechanisms. And also it means you're probably not going to stick with your diet. But, you know, losing weight is hard. We know this from study after study and personal experience after personal experience. And so two things with that. One, I think we need to be honest about why it's so hard. And it's because it's a brain regulation thing, right? It's not willpower. It's not magical ingredients. It's the fact that we live in an environment that the foods are ultra processed and they overwhelm our ability to make our brain's ability to regulate intake, and we overeat, and, you know, and then losing the weight gets really hard. The other thing is because it's so hard to change your weight when you're an adult, I think we really need to focus particularly on childhood obesity issues, because these are so hard to fix when you're an adult. You can do it, and you should do it if you need to get to a healthy weight. But man, it would be a whole lot easier for society and for everyone if we didn't get there in the first place.
Yeah, what I really took away from your book, and I think a lot of my work needs to shift from a sort of individual character. For an individual, yeah, that's all you got. But really, this is a public health issue. It's almost like, you know, telling people in, you know, 17th century, 18th century London, not to drink water from the Thames. It's like, you know, it's not like you have a choice.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. And I think the willpower thing isn't helpful, and I don't think it's right. I don't think it's a willpower issue with obesity. I think people are surrounded by a food environment that's really hard to regulate your intake with, you know? And here's what I would say. The one thing you can do maybe that's helpful is don't put it in your house, right? If you know there are foods that you are going to overconsume, if your refrigerator and cupboards are full of ultra processed foods, which we know lead people to overconsume, then maybe it's time to have a look at that and see if you can replace that with foods that are less dangerous for you, at least in your immediate environment, because that's all you can really control. You can't control the supermarket. You probably can't control what's in the break room at work, but you can control your home at least. And that's a place to start.
Right. And since reading the book, I've gone on a bland diet as an experiment. Because I have no idea how many calories I take in.
Yeah, it's really hard to track, actually.
I would get quoted exactly that diet surveys are just random number generators.
Yeah, that's pretty much true. Yep.
And so I found that, like, even though, like, okay, so I'm having, you know, tofu and tempeh and vegetables and whole grains, I'm still salting them. I'm still using sauces like sriracha that have sugar in them. I went no salt, no sugar.
Oh, wow.
And food's kind of, you know, honestly pretty bland. Like, even like I'm doing, like, you know, Mrs. Dash with like lemon oil and nutritional yeast and garlic powder and stuff like and fresh ginger. It's still bland. And I can tell I'm not eating for kicks.
Yeah, that's interesting. And have you seen the number on the bathroom scale change?
Yeah, about 7 pounds in a week and a half.
Oh my gosh. Wow. And do you feel less full than you did before, or is it the same kind of satiety, but you're just eating less to get there?
I feel as satisfied, but I don't feel as full.
Oh, that's interesting.
One of the meals I'm having is potatoes. Like I boil a bunch of potatoes, put them in the fridge, next day, eat a potato. I was putting mustard on them. And then I realized the mustard has salt. So now I'm not even doing that.
Wow. Yeah.
And then, like after three, I'm like, well, that's enough.
Yeah.
If I had sort of air fried them with, some sort of like crispy French fried spice. Oh, this is so good. Like I would.
Eat. Oh, yeah, of course. Yeah. 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 I mean, it's hard to keep to that. So that's interesting. And you're having good success with it. That's wonderful. I think the trick is, can you do it for long term? I don't know. You'll tell us.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I already shifted from sort of processed, like I don't have processed food. So I think there's an intellectual shift you can make to say, these things are not food, in the same way the Hadza will not eat snakes.
That's right. That's right. And I mean, that's why these really dramatic, that's why the low carb diets work. You basically take half the menu and say, nope, I can't eat that. Well, like you say, food is actually kind of bland, unless you put all these kind of exotic spices on it. So even if you are just going to eat steak, well, how much steak can you eat before you're done? It's like eating potatoes or eating anything. I mean, if you don't have the big, crazy mix and match of the modern diet, especially with the processing, but even, then you're not going to eat as much. You just won't.
Mm-hmm. So in the couple minutes we have left, if you were sort of dictator and you could like change laws,
yeah.
Since individual behavior is so hard to deal with, what do you recommend? You're part of the Duke Global Health Initiative. What do you recommend as policy to help humanity, not get sick and die of metabolic disease and not kill ourselves through climate disaster?
Okay. I'll do the climate one second. Let's do the obesity thing first. I think that there are a lot of places where we have direct impact as a society on what children eat. And like I said, I think childhood issues are the most important ones because those are ones that set people up for a lifetime of health or a lifetime of disease. And so there are plenty of places where we feed the nation's children in a school class, in a school lunchroom or, daycare or whatever. And I think there ought to be really tight rules and money, money to support putting good food on those kids' plates, right? School cafeteria lunches are all over the place in terms of quality. And as you might expect, poor school districts have poor food, often. And even the wealthy ones don't make it a priority all the time. And so I think that we need to focus on that. What are the kids eating? There needs to be more regulation on that and money to support it. Not just rules to say, don't do this or do it this way, but actually put our monies where our mouths are, or our kids' mouths are, and feed them well. The second thing would be, I think that we need to price in to the foods that are in the supermarket. We need to price in the societal cost. And if that's taxes on sugary beverages, that kind of thing, or taxes on processed foods. Because right now, if you walk into a supermarket, the cheapest food is the stuff that's the worst for you, right? Mm-hmm. And it doesn't have to be that way. We put billions of dollars of subsidies into all sorts of different priorities in this country.
We are putting billions of dollars of subsidy, or at least hundreds of millions, into high fructose corn syrup.
Yes. Yeah. Exactly. All that stuff. Right. I mean, and so we are already, because the pushback is, well, it's a free market and we should let it be a free market. And that's what's, well, it isn't actually, because we, like you say, we put money into high fructose corn syrup, we put money into fossil fuels development. And so there are all these monies going in that make our diet environment as perverse as it is. So we need to reprice that. And I'm not an economist. I don't know how you do it, but you have to do that. And then I think the next piece is, now you have to also price in the long-term costs of using fossil fuels versus green. And then you get people pushing toward getting away from fossil fuels, because that has to happen too. I think any climate change solution has to keep the top line number of energy burned globally more or less the same, or we're going to have a really huge societal crisis on our hands. Because, you know, I live too far from work to drive to walk every day. I live 9 miles from work, which isn't actually that far, you know, but it's too far for me to walk or even ride my bike every day. How far are you from the supermarket? How far are you from? Our society is not just transportation either, but our society is based on all this extra energy, and it will be a radical change in unhappy ways, a lot of them, to take the energy out. So we have to keep the energy there, but it has to be green. So that's the other thing you have to price in, is how do you make those incentives happen? I don't know.
Yeah. I mean, for a lot of the book, I was kind of romanticizing the Hadza.
Mm.
Until you mentioned that 4 out of 10 of their children die of infections.
Yeah.
In child, like, oh no, I don't want that. I want my,
yeah.
You know, I don't want to have parasite infections and fear of death, you know, and like,
absolutely. You know, and I mean, get back to that. You know, you asked me how I got into this business, and I went through high school not being sure what I would do with my adult life, and even into college. And then when I chose, I got to choose something what was fulfilling for me, and something I was really passionate about. And if you're a Hadza kid growing up, you can be a hunter or a gatherer, right? Those are the two job options. And that's fine. Those kids are happy and the adults are happy, and maybe that's fine. But it would be a very different society. We would have right now about, you know, one person in the food production industry makes enough to feed 35 others. Which means those 35 other people get to have a career that's not on the farm. And I don't know if societally we'd want to trade that, actually. What do you want your kids? You know, we want farmers, and that's wonderful and great, but we also want doctors and artists and teachers. And, you know, we want all these different parts of our society. And we kind of lose that a little bit if we really went back to the traditional way.
Right. Although, and I guess this is above both of our skis, around the idea of being part of a tribe and knowing you're contributing to it.
Like,
I think there's a crisis of meaning.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think that's fair. Yeah, that's a good point. How do you balance all that stuff? That's right.
So what's your next research agenda? I saw you on Twitter, you're recruiting a study on women in pregnancy and exercise.
Yeah, we're kind of, you know, so the idea that your body is sort of keeping energy expenditures constrained and keeping a fixed budget has all sorts of health implications for pregnancy, for example. So how does a mother during pregnancy, where, you know, there's so much energy demand for the pregnancy itself, how does she balance that against exercise if she wants to exercise through the pregnancy? And of course, in traditional societies, that's not an option. You have to be physically active, perhaps through pregnancy to farm or whatever. But even today, women who want to exercise through pregnancy, how do they balance that? How does that work? So that's one exciting place we're going next, is how does that actually shake out? But that's kind of the idea. We're going to keep on pushing and seeing where all of this fixed energy budget view of life takes us. That's a big one. And we'll be going to other populations around the globe as well, and more lab stuff. And that's the idea.
Awesome. I'm going to let you go. It's top of the hour. Quickly, how can people find you and follow you?
Oh, I'm most active on Twitter of all the social medias, at Herman Ponser. You can find us here online at Duke. And of course, I hope you'll check out the book, which you can get anywhere. It's called Burn, and it's anywhere you buy books, local independent place or Amazon.
And it's awesome. So you'll also burn calories. If laughter burns calories, you'll burn calories reading this book, because it's hilarious as well.
Thank you for saying that.
Thank you so much for taking the time for this amazing work and for being you.
It was really fun to have the conversation. Thanks a lot.
All right. Take care. Be well. All right. Go get the book, Burn, by Herman Ponser, PhD. If you want to support the show, you can do so by going to plantyourself.com/471, and you can order it off of the Amazon link on that page. But however you get it, audio, ebook, hardcover, just get this book. It is that important and that good a model of science writing. And like I said in the episode, it really is hilarious. I was laughing out loud on the multiple times per chapter, which is almost unheard of. I don't even laugh out loud at comedy. Great book, and I'm so grateful to Herman for taking the time to explain it to us. All right, so in garden news, we went away for the July 4th weekend, came back yesterday, and my wife has spent about 3 hours harvesting blueberries, which now raises the question, how many calories did she spend collecting those blueberries? And, you know, what kind of a return on investment is it? For me, the return on investment is terrific, although we are freezing most of them, so there's a lot of BTUs or kilowatt hours going into keeping them cold until I have them in my morning bowl. Groundhogs and deer are eating pretty much everything else. We did harvest all those potatoes, which I'm still eating. And as I mentioned in the episode, eating them pretty bland, just sort of steamed or boiled. And that's really helping with getting my weight down to my playing weight, which brings me to movement news. Getting ready for Great Grandmaster Ultimate Championships in Aurora, Colorado in a week and a half. And my weight's getting down. This morning it was like 169, 168. That's about 10 pounds down from where it's been since my knee got wonky and I stopped running in the mornings. So bland is definitely helping. Did a bunch of runs on the beach down at Hilton Head over the weekend. And I'm going to play this evening. It should be in the 90s, so there'll be a lot of thermoregulation and weight loss from water. hopefully, I will maintain my electrolytes and keep things chugging along. All right, time for thanks. Thanks to Will Ridenour for allowing me to use his beautiful song, Sabali Dawn, The Dance of Peace. You can find more of Will's music at his website, willridenour.com. And of course, thanks to all of you Plant Yourself Podcast patrons, Kim Harrison, Lynn McClellan, Brittany Porter, Dominic Maurer, Barbara Whitney, Tammy Black, Amy Good, Amanda Hatherley, Mary Jane Wheeler, Ellen Kennelly, Melissa Cobb, Rachel Behrens, Tina Scharf, Tina Ahern, Jen Filkinofsky, David Bizek, The Mysterious Michelle X, Elsbeth Feldman, Leah Stoller, Alan Christensen, Colleen Peck, Michelle Landry, Josina, Sarah Durkis, Kelly Cameron, Janet Selby, Claire Adams, Tom Franza, Jeanette Benham, Gila Sert, David Donahue, Blair Cyborg, Dorona Vizov, Gio and Carolyn Argentati, Jody Friesner, Misha Rosen, Michael Warbeck, Aviva Lael, Alicia Lemus, Val Linneman, Nick Harper, Bandana Chali, Molly Levine, The Inscrutable Harry R., Susan Laverty, The Panda Vegan, Craig Kovic, Adam Scharf, Karen Burry, Heather Morgan, Nigel Davies, Marion Blum, Teresa Koppel, Julian Watkins, Breed O'Connell, Sharon Hirschman, Linda Ayad, Holm Hedegaard, Iza Tuzinwa, Connie Hainline, Aaron Greer, Alicia Davis, Heather O'Connor, Carolyn Jensen, Sherry Olakoski of Plant Power for Health, Karen Smith, Scott Marani, Karen and Joe Crabtree, Kirby Burton, Teresa Carell, Kevin McCauley, Elizabeth Rothschild, Ann Jesse, Cheryl Dwyer, Jenny Hazelton, Peter W. Evans, Dennis Bird, Darby Kelly, Lori Fanny, Linnea Lundquist, Emily Iconelli, Levy Wallach, Rosamund McAtee, Dan Picorni, Stephen Leenan, Patty DiMartino, Mike and Donna Kartz, Deanne Bishop, Bilberry Elf, Marjorie Lewis, Trisha Adams, Nancy Sheldon, Lindsay Bayshore, Gunmarit Hagen, Tracy Gullidge, Laura Heaton, Meg from Mama Says, Stacey Stokes, Ben Savage, Michael Kay, David Hughes, Connie Rogers, Claire England, Sally Robertson, Paranganchi, Amy Daly, Brian Tourville, Mark Jeffrey Johnson, Josie Dempsey, Karen Schmidt, Pamela Hayden, Emily Perryman, Allison Corbett, Richard Stone, Lauren Vaught of Edible Musings, Aaron Hasty, Sean Owen, Sagar Nayak, Erica Piedra, Danielle Roberts, Michael Lushton, Sarah Johnson, Catherine Floyd, for your generous support of the podcast. That's it for now. As always, be well, my friends.